Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two important stories for you. The first concerns elections this weekend in Nigeria. A little later, we will hear about Germany. What part will it play in the future of Europe? Politics and more politics on this special edition of As It Is. Here is part one. Nigeria is holding elections Saturday following 2 years of political unrest. Voters will elect both a president and parliament. The ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is facing its first real test since coming to power in 1999. The lead opposition party, the All Progressives Congress, has become a powerful player in Nigerian politics since it formed in 2013. How did it happen? The All Progressives Congress, or APC, developed from an alliance of at least three regional Nigerian parties in 2013. The resulting group was large, but critics still said the new party would not survive. But then leading PDP members began to withdraw from that party and join the APC.
The headline story this week is the massive defection of some lawmakers in the House of Representatives.
Five governors joined the APC. 37 representatives followed them. Then 11 senators left the PDP for the APC, and the moves continued. In 2014, the PDP seemed to recover. The party had a new leader, and it made efforts to solve some of its problems. Some former members returned.
The most recent cross, 5,000 APC members in Kaduna State rejoined the PDP.
The movement between the parties continues even now, with just days to go before presidential and parliamentary elections. The APC and the PDP keep gaining and losing members. Some observers say results of the vote Saturday could lead to more political moves both ways. Nigerians will be electing state governors and state assemblies on April 11th.
You find people jumping ship, quite unashamedly, to the party of the president-elect.
That is Dawn Demowo, a political expert at the Abuja-based Communications and Advisory Service, Africa Practice. She says the APC's success in Nigerian party politics has a lot to do with timing. In her words, they were able to capitalize on the fact that there was disenchantment within the PDP. There were people who were ready to quit the party and move to the APC, so it got a big boost from that. One of the main areas of dispute, whether President Goodluck Jonathan broke the PDP agreement for power sharing between Nigeria's north and south. Under the agreement, each president from the north would be followed by someone from the south, and a northerner would replace a southerner. Some in the PDP believe the north was owed another term when Mr. Jonathan, a southerner, was a presidential candidate and won in 2011. But Nigerian political scientist Kabir Mato thinks the APC is riding a sea of change. He says Nigerians are slowly rejecting the traditional politics of ethnicity, religion, and local concerns. President Jonathan has dismissed the defections in his party. "Such is politics," he told reporters in February. He said there are no permanent friends or enemies in politics, just permanent interests. The APC has a majority in the House. APC members govern 14 of Nigeria's 36 states. Observers say a six-week delay of the elections has helped the ruling party. The postponement was ordered because of security issues in northern Nigeria. But the vote is still expected to be close. APC presidential candidate Muhammadu Buhari led the military government that ruled Nigeria in 1984 and 1985. He has sought the presidency several times, most recently in 2011 when he lost to Goodluck Jonathan. Mr. Buhari won the mostly Muslim North in that vote, but he was weak in the South. The APC has campaigned hard there this time. Mr. Buhari visited southern Nigeria again this week. Don Demowo says he will receive a lot more votes there this time than he did in 2011. She says it will be exciting to watch what happens. APC officials describe the presidential election as a judgment on 16 years of PDP rule. But some experts wonder how different the APC really is. There is a fair bit of the PDP establishment in this new party, and probably more will join if Mr. Buhari wins. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Some observers say Germany has the makings of a world power. They note the German government's lead in trying to solve the European financial crisis. They also point to German involvement in diplomatic efforts to stop the war in Ukraine. But other observers wonder whether Germany is ready to get more involved in world events. Christopher Jones Cruz explores the size and limits of Germany's power.
Germany is the largest economic power in Europe. The country has never been as economically strong, secure, and free as it is today. Germany is the fourth largest economy in the world and one of the top exporters. In the 24 years since Germany was unified, it has become the most valuable European partner of the United States. But it has been and is reluctant to take the lead in world events. Stephen Sabo is the executive director of the Transatlantic Academy Research Center. He wrote a book called Germany, Russia, and the Rise of Geoeconomics. He says Germany is now deciding its future.
Its whole idea of being an economic power, not a military or strategic power. Will Germany stop being a big trading state that concerned only about trading, or will it now begin to rebalance?
Stephen Sabo says it will not be easy for Germany to become a great power. He says the 2009 debt crisis in Europe caused a shift in political power on the continent. The debt crisis forced a number of European countries to cut government programs and make other financial reforms. Mr. Sabo says these measures led to a rise in extremist groups. He says the extremists do not agree on many issues, except their dislike of the steps Germany has required as a condition for economic help.
I think there's been a certain degree of arrogance about, we have the right way, you should just follow our way. This is something that they're going to have to address.
Reinhard Bütikofer is a German politician and a member of the country's Council on Foreign Relations. He says the German military is an important part of NATO's new Rapid Response Force. The alliance decided to create such a force after Russia's actions in Ukraine. Mr. Bütikofer says the German military also is expanding into other areas.
And the Germans, who are never very eager to sort of get involved militarily, have put troops into some of the Baltic countries, helping these countries that have very weak military protection of their own.
Germany is also giving weapons to Iraqi Kurdish forces for their operations against Islamic State militants. Experts say whether Germany will become a world power depends on the strength of an international political system supported by Western power. They note a lot of that support is now coming from Germany. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A United Nations representative wants international support for programs aimed at helping 28 million boys and girls return to school. The children are unable to continue their education because of wars and crises around the world. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is the UN's Special Envoy for Global Education. Mr. Brown says schools were once safe places for children. Now, he says, they are increasingly becoming instruments of war. In the past 5 years, there were more than 10,000 attacks on schools. Mr. Brown told the United Nations recently that the international community should spend money to make schools safer. He proposed creation of an international humanitarian fund for education in emergencies.
It is our moral duty to make sure that every single child in the world can enjoy the basic right to education, free of terror, free of fear, and with the support of the international community.
Mr. Brown is thinking about new uses of technology to improve school safety. A pilot program has been launched in Pakistan. 3 months ago, the Pakistani Taliban killed 140 children at a school in the city of Peshawar. Pakistani officials are now working with Predictify Me, a technology company based in the United States. Under the Pakistan Safe Schools program, schools will use new computer software to test their safety plans. The results of the testing will help school officials prepare better for emergencies. Mr. Brown said it is a major step forward in a country where more than 5 million children do not go to school. The technology will make it possible to learn what schools and governments are doing to prevent attacks on schools. The UN representative also called for the release of the more than 200 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants. He said more than 10 million children are out of school in Nigeria. The UN's Safe Schools Initiative has collected $30 million for protecting Nigerian schools. The Syrian conflict has kept 3 million children out of school, many for several years. 500,000 of them are refugees in Lebanon. Mr. Brown said it is time for the international community to wake up and deal with the problems facing children. And that's the Education Report. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. This week in our series, we talk about the presidential election of 1912. The first 10 years of the 20th century in America were shaped by the strong leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. And in the second decade, he returned to national politics to bring once more dramatic changes to the United States. Theodore Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat who became president in 1933. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt organized a new political party, the Progressives. Roosevelt created this new party after he failed to win the Republican presidential nomination. The Republican convention of 1912 had been controlled by conservative supporters of President William Howard Taft, and, as we hear now from Leo Scully and Morris Joyce, the party nominated Taft for four more years in the White House.
As a result, Roosevelt broke with the Republicans, and he and his supporters held their own convention. They formed the Progressive Party and approved a platform that promised reforms. These reforms were proposed to make the government serve the people and carry out more fully their desire for social progress. The Democratic Party also nominated a candidate who supported progressive ideas. The Democrats chose Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey, a former president of Princeton University. So, for the first time in many years, there were three major candidates for president. Wilson clearly had the best chance to win. He had the support of almost all the Democrats. The Republicans, however, were split. Some supported Taft, the others were for Roosevelt.
Roosevelt refused to accept the idea of defeat. He campaigned hard, visiting many cities and towns, making speech after speech. Wilson also campaigned hard. He seemed to enjoy it as much as Roosevelt. Taft did not like it at all. He refused to do much campaigning. He spent most of the time at his summer home. It was a quiet election campaign until the middle of October. Then, only 3 weeks before Election Day, Roosevelt was shot.
It happened in Milwaukee. Roosevelt had just left his hotel and climbed into the automobile that would carry him to the hall where he planned to make a speech. As he stood in the open car, an extremist named John Schrank ran up to him, pulled a gun from his coat, and fired a bullet into Roosevelt's chest. The bullet knocked him down. Roosevelt said it felt as if he had been kicked by a mule. He jumped up and put his hand to the wound. The bullet had passed through the inside pocket of his coat. It struck a steel case that held his glasses and went through the folded 50 pages of his written speech. These slowed the bullet, and it went only a few centimeters into his chest.
Roosevelt did not know if he was seriously wounded. He put his hand to his mouth and coughed. No blood came, and he knew the shot had not damaged his lungs. Roosevelt ordered the crowd around to stop beating Schrank. "Bring him to me," he said. He looked down at the man. "You poor creature," said Roosevelt. Then he turned away. Doctors arrived. They said Roosevelt must go at once to the hospital. But Roosevelt refused. He said he would go to the hall. "I will make this speech," he said, "or die. It will be one or the other." On his way to the hall, he told a friend, "It takes more than that to kill a Roosevelt. I do not care a rap about being shot, not a rap."
At the hall, he stood before the big crowd. His face was white, but he stood straight, without help. Someone announced that Roosevelt had been wounded, but still planned to speak. Roosevelt's voice was very low, almost a whisper. "I am going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. I'll do the best I can, but there is a bullet in me." He paused and then continued. "It is nothing. I am not hurt badly. I have something to say, and I will say it, as long as there is life in my body."
Roosevelt's speech was not important. He said nothing that he had not already said many times before. What was important, however, was his cool courage. Men did not see his act as foolish or overly dramatic. They saw it as the brave act of a strong man. To the public, he was a hero. Roosevelt spoke for almost an hour. Finally, very weak, he let himself be helped from the hall. He was rushed to a hospital where doctors could examine the wound.
The doctors found that the bullet had broken a rib, but caused no serious damage. They decided to leave the bullet where it was. The next day, Roosevelt made a statement from his hospital bed. "Tell the people not to worry about me, for if I go down, another will take my place." President Taft and Woodrow Wilson sent messages of regret to Roosevelt. They announced that they would not campaign until Roosevelt was able to do so.
Roosevelt's condition improved quickly. After 2 weeks of rest, he was ready to continue his campaign for the presidency. He made a speech to a big crowd at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Everyone was surprised to see how strong and healthy he seemed. Wilson ended his campaign in New York City the next day. He told a cheering crowd of Democrats, "What the Democratic Party proposes to do is to go into power and do the things that the Republican Party has been talking about for 16 years.
On November 5th, the people voted. The winner was Woodrow Wilson. He received more than 6 million votes. Roosevelt was second with 4 million. Taft received only about 3.5 million. Wilson's victory was even greater in the electoral vote. He got 435. Roosevelt got only 88. And Taft received only the 8 electoral votes of Utah and Vermont. The Democrats won not only the White House, but also control of Congress. And a number of Democratic governors were elected in states formerly controlled by Republicans.
The 1912 campaign ended public life for Theodore Roosevelt. Soon after the election, A friend visited Roosevelt and talked of possible victory in 1916. "I thought you were a better politician," Roosevelt said. "The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do. That is to go back to the Republican Party. You cannot hold a party like the Progressive Party together. There are no loaves and fishes, no financial support."
War was soon to break out in Europe. The United States would enter the struggle in 1917. As always, Roosevelt was ready to join in a fight. He asked for permission to organize an American force and lead it into battle in France. President Wilson, however, turned down the request. Roosevelt was sure that it was a political decision. He never forgave Wilson for keeping him out of the war. Although Roosevelt himself could not fight, four of his sons went into battle. One, his youngest son, Quentin, did not return. And when he received news of his son's death, Roosevelt wrote these words to honor him:
"Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die. And none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. All of us who give service and stand ready for sacrifice are torchbearers. We run with the torches until we fall, satisfied if we can then pass them to the hands of other runners. The torches whose flame is brightest are carried by the brave men on the battlefield, and by the brave women whose husbands, lovers, sons, and brothers struggle there. These are the torchbearers. These are they who have dared the great adventure."
Roosevelt's own great adventure was itself coming to an end. He suffered from painful attacks of inflammatory rheumatism and from a serious ear infection. He had difficulty in hearing and could not walk. But the old man was still cheerful. He spent his 60th birthday in the hospital. And to his family and friends, he said, "I am ahead of the game. Nobody ever packed more kinds of fun and interest into 60 years. Death came to Roosevelt as he slept on the night of January 6th, 1919. Said Vice President Thomas Marshall, "Death had to take him sleeping, for if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight."
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Leo Scully and Morris Joyce. You can hear our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American History series in VOA Special English.